Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio
Community
and our
radio
day three coverage of the Iditarod.
If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer,
and today we're talking to, throughout our Iditarod coverage, a good friend of mine calling in from California. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are things up there?
Well, it's nice and warm today. We're getting a little bit of snow melt, and I think we're heading towards spring. It's supposed to be in the high 30s starting next week, so we're looking forward to a little bit of breakup.
Wow. And I understand there's some weather that's moved in over the trail, some light snow where the front runners are.
Yes, I heard about that. Can you give us a report from your findings today on some of the front runners? I have an interesting prediction I made a couple of years ago about Ali Zirkel. I know we're only 50 hours into the race or so, 52 hours or so into the race, but we have a woman in lead, and that's pretty extraordinary this early in the race, but man, could she might take it.
Yeah, Ali Zirkel has always been a really, really strong musher. I believe her previous top finish before this year is 11th place, but she has come on like gangbusters and really, really dominated the early part of this race. It looks like she's going to be the first musher into McGrath. She is, I would say, about 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours outside of McGrath. The first musher to get there wins the Spirit of Alaska prize, which is a native spirit mask and $500 from Penn Air. So that's a very nice thing. And then it looks like John Baker, who won last year's race, is close behind her, but she's starting to pull ahead of him a little bit. And then further back, we've got Hugh Neff, Lance Mackey, Paul Gebhardt, Jeff King, Mitch Seavey, and a big pack of mushers chasing after Ali Zirkel.
You know, last year, Alex, on our Mushing Radio coverage of the Iditarod, I said towards the end of our broadcasts, towards the end of the Iditarod, I said, you know what, we might be talking about Ali Zirkel winning next year. So I have been following her pretty closely this year. I know she's running her husband's team, Alan Moore, primarily his team that came in second in the Yukon Quest, a very close second to Hugh Neff, and it was literally within footsteps of each other. So she has one heck of a dog team out there.
Yeah, she and Alan generally, they train together, they work together. He has primarily been focusing on mid-distance races, and generally he'll run the younger dog teams, and then Ali will take the faster dog teams on Iditarod. The team that she's running now has 10 of his dogs that he ran in the Yukon Quest. They're very fast dogs, and I think she is definitely going to be one of the top finishers this year.
I sure hope so. It is time for a woman to win the race, and what a better person than Ali Zirkel. But let's not count out some of the other women that are very close behind her. In 15th place, we have Michelle Phillips, and in 12th place, we have Didi Genro, of course, a fan favorite. Her top finish was second. She's had many top 10 finishes over her 29, I believe, Iditarod finishes. That's a heck of a career for a willow musher right in my backyard, Didi Genro.
Yeah, and Didi Genro is just a fantastic musher and a fantastic spokesperson and ambassador for the sport. And as you said, always been a big, big fan favorite. I think we're not the only people who are looking at this year's race and thinking to ourselves, it would be really great if a woman were to win. It's been a while since a woman won Iditarod, I think, since the Susan Butcher days.
Wow. Yes, it's been well over two decades then. I don't think she won since the mid-'80s, right?
I'm not sure exactly when it was, but mid to late 80s would be my guess, yeah.
Right. So, and just running them down real quick, all just about, let's see here, 36 mushers, almost well over half of the pack is in Nikolai, with the remaining in Roan and Rainy Pass. The top 10 as we stand right now at 6:35 Alaska time, Ali Zirkel, reigning champion John Baker, Jeff King, Lance Mackey, Mitch Seavey, Hugh Neff, Paul Gephardt, Dallas Seavey, Aaron Burmeister, and Jerry Willemeitzer in the top 10. So we have a heck of a lot of veterans up there in the top 10. Looking at that list, I can't tell from looking at it, but do you know where the first rookie is, Alex?
I believe the first rookie is somewhere around...
Is it Brent Sass at 22nd?
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
So Brent Sass, go ahead.
Brent is a very colorful musher who famously, when he finished the Yukon Quest this year, he had been having problems with his boots and had very sore feet. And someone said to him, well, you should just burn them. And so when he got very close to the finish line, he took some of the ethanol from his cooker, poured them all over his boots, and lit them on fire. So when he came into the finish line at the Yukon Quest, he was holding these boots that were on fire.
That is awesome. You know, his kennel name is Wild and Free, so I think something has to do with that. He is a pretty colorful guy. I know he and I talk a little bit on Facebook from time to time, and what a better guy to be in that top 25 than rookie Brent Sass. I wish him all the best.
Yeah, and down at the other end of the pack, we've got Dan Seavey. Dan Seavey Sr., who is 74 years old, who is right now in the Red Lantern position, but he is out of Rainy Pass on his way to Roan. And we were talking earlier about how everyone expected this would not be nearly as fast a race as it was last year because of the all the snowfall and because of the higher temperatures. But it was pointed out to me earlier today that we're actually only about an hour or maybe 2 hours off the record pace from last year.
Right.
So
our
expectations are that this is going to be a much slower race, but so far it has been approximately the same speed.
Right, exactly. And you know, again, a lot of people are strategizing here just 52 hours into the race. I mean, anything can happen over the next 7, 8, 9 days. So we are definitely not counting our chickens before they hatch, but it makes for very interesting radio, very interesting commentary on Facebook and Twitter to talk about what's going on this early in the race with some of these front runners. I think we're going to have a very interesting next week or so in the Iditarod.
Absolutely. And one thing that Iditarod watchers have noticed today is that we have yet to have a single team scratch,
right,
which is very unusual for this far into the race. Usually by now there have been at least two or three teams that scratch, and sometimes up to a dozen. Part of that might be because we had all that snowfall and the Happy River Steps, which we've talked about before, seem to be in much better condition, so there weren't as many people who were frazzled or injured or hurt. So far, the dogs seem to be running very well on almost all of the teams, so there haven't been any real rampant dog problems the way there sometimes have been. Perhaps part of that is that this is the first year that the Iditarod was requiring the vaccinations for kennel cough, which really just spread all through the Iditarod last year and affected quite a few dog teams. So all in all, it looks like we are having a pretty remarkable race and a very, for the most part, safe and pain-free race. It occurred to me when I said that I should not have said that perhaps I am tempting the Iditarod gods by even making that statement. But there you have it. It's already out there.
And it's out there on Mushing Radio. You know what I found very interesting, Alex, is we're on at 10:30 Eastern Time, where a great number of mushing fans live in the Northeast there, Massachusetts, Maine, New York area. And I got so many Facebook messages after our show last night saying, great show, great job. You know, I find it very interesting that people are listening at that late hour to a very small mushing radio show broadcast, you know, at a community radio channel here in Palmer, Alaska. People are listening all over the world to us. That's got to say something about just how influential this sport is becoming in the sport of dog sledding.
Yeah, it's one of those things where there definitely are not as many fans of dog mushing as there are of, say, professional football or a sport like that. But the people who are fans of dog mushing tend to be much more passionate about the sport.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, if you're going to stay up all hours of the night listening to radio and posting on Facebook and Twitter, and like you said before you got on the air, Alex, you don't get much sleep during the Iditarod. You're up there tweeting and reading and posting and watching videos in the late hours too, aren't you?
I absolutely am, and I sometimes feel guilty when I go away from the computer for a few hours and go do things in my so-called real life that take me away from the Iditarod, because there's always something going on. There's always something to look at or to you know, listen to. I've gotten tons of messages on Facebook, emails, and Twitter messages, and I should encourage everyone to like the Dogworks Radio page on Facebook. We're doing a contest where we're giving away every day an advanced screening copy of Mush the Movie, and so you should definitely go and do that. And follow me on Twitter at Coldfoot Films and at Dogworks Radio and at Robert Forto. And there's just a ton of stuff going on social media. We're trying to post as much stuff to the Facebook page as we can. And we absolutely welcome any comments or questions or requests that anyone out there has.
And we're going to get to one of those requests here in just a second, but I just want to make one further point about the timeline of the race in terms of how people follow it. This truly is a 24-hour event, and for folks that don't know a lot about mushing, most mushers will take their dogs out in the cooler hours, which would be running at night. So you'll often see a lot of folks resting during the day, especially if you're looking at some of the leaderboards and things like that. You'll see a team resting most of the daylight hours, and they tend to run in the evening when it's much cooler. It is getting cooler or warmer here in Alaska. Just mentioned at the beginning of the show that it's going to be in the high 30s over here in the Mat-Su Valley. But that is way too warm to run a very competitive dog team. Dogs like to run anywhere from minus 10 to minus, you know, to plus 10. That 20-degree area seems to be optimum temperature for running dogs. So when you're in the high 30s and the height of the day and the sunshine, it's tough on a dog team.
Yeah, and mushers are very careful when they have to run in those temperatures to make sure that they give their dogs plenty of food and plenty of water and guard against them overheating, which can easily happen, at those temperatures. And most of the time, as you said, the mushers will choose to rest the dogs during the hotter hours of the day so they can run them in the early morning, in the evening, and at night.
Right. So let's get into the topic of today's show. It's about the cost of the Iditarod, and this often comes up a bunch, at least when I'm talking to new mushers or just recent fans of the sport. They wonder just how much it costs to run something like the Iditarod or even maintain an Iditarod caliber team, whether it be long distance or mid distance preparing for the Iditarod or something like that. And just to give it a little bit of personal perspective, in our kennel we have 45 plus dogs with 32 of those guys in racing condition, meaning they're of racing caliber, of age, or of health. And we spend upwards of $2,000 to $2,500 a month on the care and feeding of those dogs. That's well over $24,000 a year just for feeding of those dogs. When you think about the Iditarod entry fee, if I'm not wrong, and correct me if I am, Alex, I believe it is $3,500 for the entry. Is that true?
I believe so. I know that they've raised it in the past couple of years, but it's in that area.
So $3,500 for an entry fee, then you put on that $2,000 to $2,500 a month for dog food, and that's for a very small kennel. Some of these guys have well over 100 dogs. I know Lance Mackey and Martin Booser and those guys have quite a few more dogs than we do, so double that if they have 80 or more dogs. And then the cost of running the race itself and the transportation and all that is included. The goal of the entire Iditarod is to make it to Nome. And one of the prizes of finishing the Iditarod is a belt buckle. Everybody that finishes gets that belt buckle, and I always call it the $40,000 belt buckle. $40,000 is a pretty good estimate of what it costs a team to run the Iditarod. And people will think, man, that's expensive. And I know you have a great quote that I want you to share with us in just a second from your movie. But think about a two-week vacation that cost you $40,000 to take. And that kind of gives you a little bit of perspective. What do you think about the cost of running the Iditarod?
You know, it's certainly something that is so expensive that it scares a lot of people off from doing it. And that's good and bad. It's good in that the people who end up doing it are people who really, really want to do it and people who are going to figure out a way that they can pay for it. It's perhaps bad in that maybe we would like to have it be a little bit more open and have a few more competitors. It might be nice to have 80 teams instead of 66, but it's good that it's self-selecting. And that helps keep a lot of the dilettantes who just want to come in and do something because they think it's cool away from it. I think we've talked, you and I personally, not on the air, about the fact that there are very few people who actually make a living out of running dogs. And that number is probably about 8 or 10 people. So there's 66 people running the Iditarod this year, and that means that 56 to 58 of them are at best breaking even and at worst just pouring money into this. It's not for the faint of heart, and it's not for someone who is going to be easily scared off by the financial aspect of it.
That's a great point, and just my personal experiences on what I'm dealing with. You know, I moved up here to Alaska to train for and run this Iditarod, and of course I bought a home and moved my family up, and a lot of guys do that. They'll come up with a U-Haul trailer of their worldly possessions and start to train for the Iditarod. I know Justin Savatis, my neighbor right down the road from me, did the same thing. He and his wife packed up the old truck, like they say, in Beverly Hillbillies, and they moved to Alaska, and here he is running, I believe, his second Iditarod. He did finish last year. So it is entirely possible to do. And one thing that I always get asked is, why don't you go chase after sponsors? And the common response to that is, people don't want to sponsor a nobody. You know, somebody that hasn't proven themselves, you know, they don't want to give them X dollars to go out and run a race if they haven't proven themselves to be capable of number one finishing, and that's an entirely a different story altogether, and we'll talk about it more in this show. But also, you know, the feel of the race and how they're going to respond to them as a sponsor on the trail is a big deal, at least in corporate America. Do you have any take on that, Alex?
It absolutely is, and even mushers who have consistently had maybe not top 10, but top 20 finishes often have problems attracting big sponsors. I'm hoping that as we move into more of a social media world, that there's going to be a lot more crowdsourcing of Iditarod sponsorships and people being able to cobble together the money for sponsorships from much smaller donors and not have to be looking for the big dog food companies or the big, you know, the big telecommunications companies or whoever it is who do the big sponsorships.
Right, right.
And most mushers that I know are actively always seeking sponsorship from anyone who can help them.
That's exactly right. And just to add one more thing to our how much does it cost to run the Iditarod, most people think that we're just up here running dogs all day and, you know, living the life, so to speak. But most of us, if we don't work a full-time job during the day and then come home in the middle of the night and run dogs, most of us work during the summer months. It's a very typical employment schedule to work during the summer months, whether it be in construction or some type of other industry. And then we take the winters off to train for the Iditarod or whatever races we're doing. But we're working during the summer months, of course, when it's dang near 24-hour light up here. We're working almost double time in the summer to make sure that we can save enough to live off of, I guess, during the winter when we're training our dogs.
Yeah, and a lot of mushers and a lot of people who run dogs deliberately choose a lifestyle where they can get high-paying jobs that they can work for a few months at a time and then make enough money to support their dog habit, so to speak.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about food drops. And I just want to add one thing to that. Just today I had to run down to Anchorage from Willow with Hugh Neff's backup sled. I had to send it off to Unicolete on the airplane. A musher can have a backup sled in case something happens to his sled that he's using, or he wants a faster, lighter sled for the finishing part of the race. And just another expense of Iditarod, it costs $95 in shipping just to ship that sled up on the airplane. And a lot of people, again, think about how much it costs to do things like that. But just a sled, 80 pounds, costs $95. In terms of food drops, I don't know exactly how many food drops that each musher is allowed, but it is hundreds, if not 1,000 pounds of food and gear. What can you share about that, Alex?
Yeah, the way it works is that there are bags that have the names of all of the checkpoints on them, and the mushers will pack those bags with food for the dogs, sometimes with little treats for themselves as well, and then they take all of those bags to a central drop-off point in Anchorage where they are weighed, and then the musher pays the freight to ship them out to the various checkpoints. So at any given checkpoint, there will be, usually somewhere outside, there will be a big row of bags that have all of the musher's names that are alphabetized so that the musher can come in, find his or her bag, get the food if they need it, and then take off on the trail. And I believe Sylvia Vertvangler had the heaviest food drop this year, and she had a video of it that we'll post on our DogWorks radio page later. But it was 2,700 pounds.
Holy cow.
So well over a ton. And then I'm not sure how much they pay per pound, but they do pay per pound, and that's why it's weighed. Now, interestingly enough, what happens is because there are so many different checkpoints and you're not sure exactly how fast you'll be going and you're not sure of what the weather condition is going to be and where you're going to stop and take your 24-hour rest, mushers end up shipping a lot of food to different checkpoints that they may or may not use. What happens if the musher goes through the checkpoint and doesn't take their bag or doesn't use their food is that the dog food is distributed to local dogs in the village, and if there's any personal items, those are sent forward for the musher to get at a later checkpoint.
And I believe there's 24 checkpoints in the northern route, which they run on even years, which 2012 is. And if a musher can have 4 or 5 bags per checkpoint, that's a big ordeal. I remember talking with Hugh Neff when he was preparing his drop bags, and he started pretty much right after Christmas to prepare his bags for the Iditarod, which starts in early March. So just imagine how much time and effort that takes to prepare for the big race, you know, a month and a half, 2 months beforehand.
Right, and the mushers are responsible for providing the food for their dogs as they move down the trail. So you have to think about what exactly it is that your dog team is going to is going to eat and is going to perform best with eating, and then usually cut up that food or put it into plastic bags or have it in some form so that you can get at it quickly and prepare it and give it to your dogs and not waste a lot of time. And that really can be kind of a science into itself. And mushers have experimented with different types of food and with different mixtures of protein and fat. And there's a real science to it. And everyone has their little treats that they like to have. A lot of teams use salmon treats for the dogs when they're just snacking them. And it's really a very personal thing. And there are some dogs who like some things and some who like others. So you have to figure all of that out and then plan it for your drop bags. And then, you know, organize it, bring it down to Anchorage, and have it sent out to the trail.
You know, just to end that segment of the show, Martin Bucer says it best. He says that his dogs take about 10,000 to 12,000 calories per day. And a little kid asked him, how much was that? And he said, think about 30 Big Macs a day per dog. And that's what each dog on his team eats every day, 30 Big Macs. So that's a heck of a lot of calories and a heck of a lot of food. So, Alex, we have about 3 minutes left. We already talked about our giveaway. We haven't mentioned where to find us. You can find us on RadioFreePalmer.org on our live feed. And then shortly hereafter the broadcast, we do have a podcast over at DogWorks Radio or MushingRadio.com. And we'll post it all over the place on Facebook and Twitter. It's been very quick this evening on our show, Alex. We did cover some great stuff. What do you want to talk about tomorrow? I know people will be rolling into Takotna, which is a very popular 24-hour layover checkpoint for a lot of mushers. So we're going to start seeing some significant rest with the teams here coming up in the next day or so. What else do you think is going to be happening in the next 24 hours? Pretty quickly, Alex, we have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, I think there, you know, obviously anything can happen, but we'll be talking a little bit about the leaders, a little bit about the people at the back of the pack. Hopefully there will continue to be no significant problems in any of the teams, but if there are, we'll cover it. I think we want to talk about a little bit about the Teacher on the Trail program and some of the educational opportunities that the Iditarod offers, which is something that casual fans might not know about, but is really fascinating and really a great part of the Iditarod organization.
Exactly. And, of course, we will report any significant news that we hear throughout the day on our leads, I guess, from the Iditarod. We talked to quite a few people in the 24-hour cycle of the Iditarod, so we'll make sure that we update that as much as we can over on our Facebook page and our Twitter feeds as well. Alex, again, I appreciate you doing this. I know you're an Alaska fan living in California. You're welcome to come up anytime and hang out with the dogs. I know you're itching to. You're looking for that cell phone with the 907 area code pretty quickly.
I am, and I need my dog fix, I think.
The cat just doesn't do it, even though he or she is named after some points in Alaska.
Exactly. We have a cat named Sitka P. Coldfoot, named after two places in Alaska, and no one knows what the P stands for.
There you go. So that is Alex Stein. Make sure you check him out on Facebook and Twitter. His Twitter handle is Coldfoot Films. He's the director of Mush the Movie, and we will make sure that you guys can see that as soon as possible. Alex, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again tomorrow, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
You're welcome. This is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio, mushingradio.com, here at 89.5 KVRF in Palmer, Alaska. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Sutton, Radio Free.